The Barger Estate Massacre, an epic historical nonfiction novel of injustice. Copyright 2013 by Poor Innocent Victim, Albert Barger. It's hard being a genius like me, Al Barger. Seems like everywhere I turn, fools are lined up like a confederation of dunces conspiring against me. This brings me to the 3-year period from 2008 to 2011, spent wrestling over my father's modest estate. It took a while for the thieves and lawyers to accomplish the prime directive, which was, screw Al. This gripping, dramatic story would surely have great commercial potential as a movie thriller in the hands of the Coen brothers or Tim Burton. In fairness, I suppose I must open by saying that I unwittingly, or really more like witlessly, volunteered for some of the boning. My father, shopkeeper and gun trader extraordinaire, Howard Barger, passed in May 2008. Leaving me in the home with a half dozen coon dogs while we figured out how to settle his bills and make a 3-way split between 3 brothers, which should have been fairly simple. I should have known better than voluntarily agreeing to let baby brother become the personal representative. For starters, his eagerness for the position, even before we got the geezer in the ground, should have been a clue. Duh. I can only claim that he bypassed my brain and went at a sentimental blind spot during a tender moment. After me and the middle brother Stephen agreed to let baby brother be the executor, he had, as he later described the position, quote, all power, end quote, and turns out also to be tethered to some horrible ball and chain of resentment at his no-good big brother Al. Whatever. However, I prefer to make a minimum of speaking ill, publicly or privately, of my blood brother. I'm mostly explaining this story for the purpose of making publicly known in a perhaps marginally entertaining manner the unprofessional and dishonest behavior of a cheesy lawyer and judge. Those would be a lion shyster named Gary E. Smith out of Connersville, Indiana, and the Honorable Judge J. Stephen Cox of the Franklin County, Indiana Circuit Court. The lawyer hiring and judge electing public ought to know what they're dealing with. There's a public interest here, besides me wanting to get it off my chest. But I do have to acknowledge that this nonsense was ultimately all at the behest of Michael Eli Barger Sr. He was so willful in pushing his grudge against me that he hired a lying shyster to manipulate a willing and ridiculously narcissistic judge. Michael Eli Barger Sr. was willing to break his oral and written agreements with his own brothers and to absolutely lie repeatedly under oath in a court of law against his own brothers. Otherwise, none of the rest of this would be. So then the first thing he had to do was to get rid of the estate attorney that the 3 of us had agreed to. Turns out that we had accidentally hired an honest, conscientious Christian lawyer, whose good name I will not be smirched by repeating it here in association with this foolishness. An honest Christian attorney. I mean, what are the odds of such a thing? Looking for the opposite of that, though, baby brother easily enough scraped up a proud, puffed-up little lion shyster named Gary E. Smith, out of Connersville, Indiana, also known hereafter as Key Rock. I can say from first-hand experience that this lawyer will not just misdirect, but directly lie, that is, say things that he knows are not true, in open court against paying clients. He will purposely, surreptitiously sabotage paying clients who are trusting him to work for them honestly in writing legal pleadings, which point of broken trust cost me personally at least $40,000. Also, he isn't very good at even simple math. Repeatedly filing accountings with the court off by tens of thousands of dollars from his own numbers on those same documents. Besides being crooked and malicious, he's just not the brightest bulb in the pack, frankly. But he certainly does think right highly of himself. He's come to put me very much in mind of Key Rock, Phil Hartman's Saturday Night Live unfrozen caveman lawyer. He's a Neanderthal in a suit. He obviously thinks he's Mr. Big Stuff because he's managed to weasel his way into a little pile of cash in Connersville, Indiana. Well, color me dazzled. He's quite impressed with his power and influence. But really, he's just a half-educated caveman pushing worse BS than Key Rock's lame personal injury lawsuits on SNL. For one thing, attorney Gary E. Smith of Connersville, Indiana in Fayette County will willingly lie under oath in a court of law against paying clients. In July of 2009, I was in court where Gary Smith had come to ask the court to make me turn over my Malibu car with my name on the title. The other two brothers had agreed not to claim the Malibu. They had bigger fish to fry. They had Gary Smith put it in writing that the estate had, quote, no further interest, end quote, in the car and was working to release the bank lien from the title. Gary Smith signed a letter to this effect on behalf of the estate and sent this letter to me. Unfortunately, I showed up in court that particular day without this document in hand. Gary E. Smith perfectly well knew that he had personally written and signed the no further interest letter just a couple of months previous, but he simply denied writing any such letter. In anticipation of this hearing, I reminded Key Rock of this letter so he would have a chance to look it up in the unlikely event that he had somehow honestly forgotten writing it. Nonetheless, here's how it came out in court. From July 9, 2009, Franklin County Court recording. Al, you told me that the estate has, quote, no further interest in that car. Gary E. Smith. I didn't say that at all. Let's get that straight. Now, from a January 28, 2009 letter to Al from the Smith Law Office. Enclosed are the duly endorsed certificates of title for two vehicles that are in your name. You should contact the License Bureau promptly in order to be timely in the obtaining of the license needed to operate the vehicles, and further, you need to insure both vehicles since they are now titled to you and the estate has no further interest. Signed, Gary E. Smith. Thus, Gary E. Smith, in my employ as an heir, directly and knowingly lied to the judge against me. In an honest legal system, such documentable ill behavior, and I found the original letter an hour later, would be grounds for disbarment. But then this judge wanted to be repeatedly lied to as regards Al Barger on numerous occasions, and indicated immediately that he was ruling in the estate's favor. Just from listening to this July 2009 hearing again, I noticed at least two other direct lies from Gary E. Smith in court, notably this utter fabrication regarding the Schwab stock account. Gary E. Smith, quote, until today, he wouldn't even turn it over to us. The petition I was going to file was prepared by my staff. Counsel staff has made several attempts to obtain Albert Barger's signature on the authorization from him transferring the Schwab account. He won't return our phone calls. That's the way that works. I'm saying that as an officer of the court. End quote. Now, in fact, I had repeatedly requested that they get me paperwork to sign over those scraps of stock. But Smith only just presented it to me a few minutes before this July hearing. In March, shortly after the agreement, he had me sign a paper to authorize the estate to look at my account. He could have just as easily given me a document such as he claimed to transfer my account to the estate as we had agreed. By the way, one of Kerouac's tells, where you can tell that he's lying, is when he invokes his status of trust as an officer of the court, as he did here. He made similar invocations in close vicinity of a couple of other purposely spoken untruths in just that one hearing. Gary Smith certainly knows how to bellow like a good caveman, too. Alone with him in an empty hallway 5 minutes later, I referred to him reasonably calmly as a lying shyster. He and I both knew that he had just lied multiple times against me right there in court. So, Kerouac bellowed at some close range in my face about how he'd sue me for libel for that remark if I had anything to sue for. He had apparently been recently eating something with heavy garlic, if memory serves. But lest the likes of Kerouac contemplate retribution against Old Al for this goofy scrawl, I'll note that I'm pretty sure that my memory of journalism law class does serve where I was taught that truth is an absolute defense against charges of libel in American law. So then, being careful to be scrupulously honest in my testimony here, the garlic breath thing there was just a minor literary flourish. In careful truth, I just vaguely remember his breath smelling bad. But it could have been anything. Garlic just sounded funnier. Yes, sir, he was a badass, though, barking at me like the alpha dog. I was thoroughly intimidated. I fought off an urge to curl up in the fetal position and protect my parts. This reminds me of a Richard Pryor bit. Why, you black guys always holding your things. You done took everything else, Jack. Further, Kerouac told me that I was no longer welcome in his office. This was despite being a paying client, eventually at a third of $25,000 plus for his professional services. All right then, by rights, I must accept one more major acknowledgement of foolishness on my own part. It was only after that little debacle in July, over a year on, that I broke down and hired an attorney. I was thoroughly broke and also really, really didn't want to hire a lawyer to go after a brother in court. Even Brother Stephen, with whom I was still in an adversarial position to this point, had repeatedly urged me to get counsel. In defense of my efforts as my own legal counsel, I can only ask for leniency of judgment for my poor performance on the grounds that I had a fool for a client. Now then, there is the crown prince of this dance of dunces, Franklin County, Indiana Circuit Court Judge J. Stephen Cox. This guy's working on such a low personality level of cheap, self-absorbed pride and prejudice that he certainly should not be in any position of authority over other human beings. I wouldn't trust him with the authority of being a ship manager at a Dairy Queen. He exhibits a hateful and prejudicial personality, even towards a person like me who is not in his court as a criminal, if it suits him for whatever arbitrary personal reasons, to the point that he ignores the law and even written agreements that he has personally signed off on in order to enforce the prime directive, which is, of course, Screw Al. Basically, J. Stephen Cox is Eric Cartman from South Park demanding, respect my authority. The difference is that Judge Cartman actually has serious power over other people's lives. It has been suggested, in explanation of my problem here by a PhD psychologist, that perhaps I exude some anti-authoritarian pheromone that the likes of Judge Cartman can simply smell, no matter how I try to hold my tongue. I'm lucky I came out from under this emotional cripple just losing my shirt. He was about a half step away from locking me up for driving my own car. I'd hate to think what kind of treatment I'd get from this ridiculous person if I had to come in front of him as any kind of even a minor criminal defendant. Now, when I say that Judge Cox wanted to be lied to if it furthered the prime directive, that was in evidence at all half-dozen hearings, but most directly at the next hearing in September of 2009. At that point, I showed up appealing his decision on the Malibu in good confidence, as now I came with, one, the document with Gary Smith's signature on it proving his lie, and two, an attorney to present this as properly written motions for the court. Judge Cartman, however, was not impressed in the least. It didn't matter what my agreements were that we had in writing. He, Judge Cartman, had not signed off on it. Respect my authority and hand the car over. Judge J. Stephen Cox didn't care a whit that the estate attorney had been shown to be lying to him against a paying client. Like I said, Judge Cox wanted to be lied to. Tell me lies. Tell me sweet little lies. Let's move on then to the courthouse hallway in Brookville on a lovely November day in 2009 for some skullduggery between Michael and Key Rock versus Stephen and Reason. According to Stephen's written and sworn public testimony, these two clever fellows insisted to Stephen that they could not accept an offer to buy the Malibu from the estate in kind against his eventual settlement to settle this issue, because the estate needed the cash to pay the bank because the estate was in a, quote, financial crisis, end quote. But the bank was only owed $2,000 at that point, and a few minutes later, Key Rock was explaining in court how we had sold land pending approval of the court, and that he right now had a $20,000 down payment check in hand. Right there, wait, Gary E. Smith of Connersville, Indiana, bald-faced, lied to a client in order to sabotage his and my interest. Did I mention that me and Stephen paid two-thirds of the freight for this lying shyster? It's communism and terrorism, I tell you. Speaking of communism and terrorism, let me give you Key Rock's most clever trick of caveman economics. He apparently purposely simply ran Howard's main debt, a $48,000 bank loan, into default for over a year. Now, the estate held more than twice that value in stock in the bank to which the loan was owed. Indeed, that was the collateral for the loan in the first place. The estate purposely put off the obvious point of selling the bank back some of our stock to cover the loan as they were asking, and ran up Lord knows what kind of extra interest and penalties, or the point of even just selling enough stuff from a near $500,000 estate to keep making Howard's $500 a month payments. Heck, the continuing dividends on that bank stock would have paid half the payments without selling anything at all. Speaking as a forensic pathologist for what's left of my dumb cracker ass, the only and obvious point of running this loan into an expensive default like this was to use that as a club to beat Ole Al and take my little bit of stuff and generally fulfill the prime directive. The financial crisis of the defaulted loan means that really the only way to pay that mortgage was to sell my home and or my car out from under me. There's $100,000 plus in bank stock, but really they've just got to have my 5-year-old Malibu to pay towards a $48,000 debt. They eventually sold the bank enough stock to leave $2,000 in debt to hold over me, the $2,000 they were moaning about to Stephen. Now, the most memorably, contemptibly, comically disgusting display of Judge Cox's Cartman complex came before me a few minutes later that day in November of 2009, again involving the ever-so-controversial Malibu. I was late but 3 weeks at that point from obeying his order to physically surrender to the estate my only means of transportation from 15 miles out in the countryside while I was still hustling to secure another vehicle. I didn't like dragging my feet on fulfilling a court order, but I was slightly less scared of those bad possibilities right at that moment than of being absolutely stranded. Rather than wait 2 more weeks for me to hand over the Malibu, as I had told the estate in writing I would do by the end of the month, they had me dragged back into court, hoping to get me thrown in jail for contempt of court. Plus, this gave Gary Smith an excuse to run up at least $1,500 in extra legal charges over the maybe $3,000 actual value of my car. This is, again, also rather than accept or even consider or negotiate the offer from Stephen to pay for it in kind, as Stephen had repeatedly made in writing to settle the matter simply between us. That would have settled the matter, but it wouldn't do much to screw Al. So this is a prime example showing that the point of a lot of this business was malice and spite against me, rather than even simple and relatively clean greed. The point for Michael, Gary Smith, and Judge Cox for going along with all this nonsense was not to maximize value for the estate, even at my expense. All right, sell the car to Stephen or Al and be done with it. Rather, the estate attorney Keyrock ran up thousands of dollars in extra legal fees over insisting on absolutely physically confiscating a vehicle with my name on the title worth no more than $3,000. Howard Barger would certainly have hated the idea of this turd burglar getting a fat chunk of his belongings or our car, as who wouldn't? Fortunately for me, however, by that November day, his crowned majesty, Judge Cartman, was just so tired of screwing with this car that he decided on the spur of the moment to leave the car with me and have the estate charge me for it. Heading into the holidays, he apparently just didn't want to be bothered with the paperwork to lock me up. Ah, Fortuna, the wheel spins upward. This brings us to that very special moment of Cartmanicity that I mentioned. Judge Cox spreads his arms out dramatically like he was Jesus giving himself on the cross at Calvary and tilts his head dramatically to one side as he declares with a Christ-like benevolent smile, not, Father forgive them, but rather, I guess I'm just going to have to swallow my pride and not put anyone in jail for disobeying my orders. If memory serves, I believe he managed to repeat that exact imagery of his great magnanimity thrice that day and again at later hearings. Judge Cox seems to really, really like swallowing pride. I'm just saying. End result, I kept the Malibu and the estate charged Stephen $7,000. Thanks again, Stephen. The main important thing here was not probate law, our written agreements, Howard Barger's intentions in putting my name on the car, fiduciary responsibility on the part of the estate, or anything about me getting back and forth to work. No, the main important thing was the grievous disrespect to Judge Cartman's authority. I know that by rights in that moment, I should have been grateful simply that I wasn't going to jail. Yet somehow I found myself feeling very much like Otto having to apologize to John Cleese in A Fish Called Wanda, i.e., wanting to choke the living crap out of a badly deserving jackass. I'm just want to say that I'm sorry, Your I'm sorry that I still not wishing to go to jail, however, I repressed all such urges. Instead, I let my calm and seasoned attorney say something appropriate like, "Thank you, Your Honor." This also saved me having to try to say "Your Honor" with a straight face and without choking the living crap out of Judge Cartman, which would certainly not have turned out well for me, no matter how badly the self-absorbed sumbitch deserved it. Note, you cannot put a beat down on judges or other elected public officials for any reason. You cannot even smack them with a rolled-up newspaper. Apparently, they passed some law. To me, such a law would seem to be a clear violation of our constitutional system of checks and balances. I mean, how else are you supposed to keep the bastards from peeing on the carpet? Perhaps somebody needs to take a refresher course on the Federalist Papers. Okay? Dropping back now to get the main nut. Our first court appearance in February 2009 should have largely settled most of this, as we ended the day with a detailed written agreement between us. After it became clear in court that I had to pretty much do whatever the other two wanted, or Judge Cartman would bang the gavel right now, today, okaying the sale of my home from under me, and you and the coon dogs got 30 days to find someplace else to be. Now, for starters, Gary E. Smith was poisoning the well for me with the judge behind my back before I even met him on that literally and figuratively cold February day. That's a lovely thing to do to a paying client. According to what he explained to Stephen at the time, he was in chambers privately working on Judge Cox before court, telling him that I was mentally disturbed, kind of off my beam. That was why I gave the estate a bill for caregiver services for the 7 years I spent taking care of Dad. Now, I didn't draw or ask for any regular pay beyond room and board in that time, but Dad took it on himself, unbidden, to put my name on a Schwab stock account in a car. We didn't have any big discussions on any of this. The geezer was always reluctant to the point of queasy about discussing end-of-life issues, as the more delicate would put it. That's why we were working from a 30-year-old will. Not that this simple form was itself ever in any dispute. Well, why wouldn't you just take that stuff Howard put your name on as his intended recompense and leave it at that? Asked an already clearly hostile and exasperated Judge Cox during this our first appearance. I explained that I would gladly do that, Your Honor, except that the estate is already today in front of you trying to pry those very things away from me. If they're going to take those things, then I need to ask directly for compensation. Apparently that was crazy thinking. Judgy Wudgy just glared daggers at me, like old Al really is off his rocker. Hostility, of course, being the appropriate response to someone who's mentally disturbed. By the way, as it happens, I had a formal psychiatric evaluation for unrelated insurance purposes in December of 2010. So I have it in writing that I can prove that I am not insane. Nor did written tests or a formal interview with a PhD psychiatrist indicate any obviously diagnosable ics or isms. Apparently, there's nothing wrong with me mentally. I'm just an asshole. Somebody here is off their rocker, though, and I got papers to prove that it's not me. So, as Gary Smith prearranged with Judge Cox before the start of proceedings, after making it clear that he would be glad to cast aside normal estate law, which says that an heir living in a family home is usually presumed to have a right to take the home from their part of the estate, and put me on the sidewalk, what with the financial crisis in the estate and all. Judge Cox granted a continuance for a couple of days to let the heirs try to come to an agreement amongst all three of us. As I later came to understand it, Michael's basic preference was to take the opportunity of an offer on my house to put me on the street. He ultimately tried to put me out of my home three times during the course of settling the estate. This one time, he could have probably gotten the job done if he had squeezed the trigger. Stephen, however, was not interested in screwing me, as he understood it, but he badly wanted my joint Schwab account with Howard handed over to the estate. Michael obviously wanted this as well. It was in my name, with no kind of lien, and the estate had not even tried to legally claim it. But Stephen had in mind, as a matter of principle, that Howard had at some point indicated to him orally in some way that the account was intended for all the brothers to share. Stephen prevailed in his will over Michael at this point to the extent of getting him to use this opportunity of having me over the barrel to make a chess game fork move, voluntarily give up the Schwab account they had no claim to, or give up my home. I have to credit Stephen for sharp strategery. So then, after court of February 2009, per Stephen's design, the three brothers went directly to the Goldfinch restaurant for a meal and negotiations. Stephen took conscientious notes as I agreed to hand over the account and take a hit for all cash I took out of the account after Howard passed, among other things. It was, as Stephen is proud to note, a fairly hard bargain. Uncle, you win. But I get to keep my house and a little bit of my ass, and I can live with it. Immediately, Stephen came home with me and literally stood over my shoulder as I wrote up our carefully detailed agreement as a letter to our estate attorney, Gary E. Smith. Here's what we all agreed to. Please write this up as a motion for the court. Michael couldn't specifically sign an agreement, as he had already agreed to sell my home to a buyer, and thus it had to be presented as a motion in opposition by the other two brothers. Negotiated by all three brothers and written by the estate attorney, and thus with the implicit approval of the estate. That was the point of the carefully engineered recess to give us a minute to make this deal. This right here was the first and most important point where attorney Gary E. Smith of Connersville, Indiana, purposely sabotaged by deceit and betrayal of professional trust his paying clients Stephen and Albert Barger. Turns out that he carefully weasel-worded what we had agreed to in order to give him wiggle room to make up whatever him and Michael wanted to later. The main point of this cleverness was carefully leaving out the repeatedly used word cash from the phrase cash withdrawals in the agreement we sent him. Thus, as it ultimately turned out in the practice, giving him license to charge me $40,000 to the estate for money that I had lost from my own account in the market crash of 2008 after Howard passed. So, I'm out $40,000 twice. Ouch! This was pure treachery on Gary E. Smith's part against his own paying clients. Seems like such deceit would be considered prosecutably unprofessional in any other profession. On the other hand, such lawyerly cleverness was hardly necessary in Judge Cartman's kangaroo court. He had our written agreement as we originally sent it to Key Rock in evidence. Judge Cox looked at our agreement that we sent Smith, then the document he gave us to present as a motion in court, and now Smith's obvious bad faith in asking to rob me for $40,000 in unmistakable violation of our clear and simple written agreement that we presented him. Again, Judge Cartman had written evidence of Key Rock's treachery to his paying clients and cared not. Ultimately, in his final written decision settling the estate in November 2010, Judge Cox didn't even pretend that he was enforcing our written agreement that he had in fact specifically personally signed off on March 10th, 2009. So even Judge Cox's written word isn't good for much. Rather, a year and a half later, he granted every bogus made-up charge from the estate according to his published judgment for the sake of, quote, equity. Judge Cartman's idea of equity ultimately was that as one-third heir of what started out to be a near $500,000 estate, I got no money, but actually owed the estate $16,000 yet on my $66,000 property. Prime directive fairly well accomplished, I'd say. It took most of an extra year to finish screwing me at the end, though, in large part because Gary E. Key Rock Smith can't do simple math even when he's making up the figures to add. He filed the first of ultimately three final accountings with the court in May 2010, with his math in the document off by $28,000 on the bottom line, based on his own figures in that very court document filing. By his figuring, I was $21,000 ahead of my fair share for the sake of the value of the house, and because he said so. Thus, he proposed I get my house only subject to a lien of $21,000 to Michael and a lien of $21,000 to Stephen. This would be as opposed to the obvious correct answer of splitting $21,000 three ways, thus making a $7,000 lien to each of the other brothers. Now, class, what is 21 divided by 3? You in the back there, Key Rock. When Stephen detailed this math error to the estate, Gary Smith resubmitted the document at court calling for two $14,000 liens, off by only $14,000 this time. Key Rock finally got his own math straight on the third try. Now, this was obviously merely professional incompetence rather than actual malice, so I guess I should count this as the lesser of his sins. Hey, you can't expect a caveman to be good at math. One last bit of treachery lay dormant for a year till I got my first property tax bill in the spring of 2012 to discover that Key Rock had managed to transfer the property in 2011 with $1,000 in back taxes still attached. Plus interest, of course. Just a little last kiss. So, yeah, I kind of got hosed. But on the other hand, this whole mess has somehow turned into a positive blessing between Stephen and me. We hadn't gotten along much at all for a good many years, frankly. And he certainly spoke harshly to me repeatedly and at length before and after Howard's passing. He'd likely tell you it was for my own good. Plus, there was the Schwab account thing. I certainly wanted pretty badly to go upside his head on a good many occasions. And vice versa, I'm sure. We're much better now, though. For one thing, it seemed to satisfy something that he needed when I conceded that damn Schwab account in February 2009. He didn't care a whit when it turned out that the decimated remains of that account really were worth less than $2,000, as I had insisted in court before we made the deal. It satisfied his perceived point of principle, and he was good and increasingly supportive from there. "You've been punished enough," he explained to me at one point. "Yeah, okay, close enough." In retrospect, Gary Smith lying against me in court over the damn Malibu became a big point of reconciliation between Stephen and me. We had a deal! was Stephen's new and much more appreciated point of principle now. This only became a more assertive statement as the estate came out with their first fictionalized final accounting in May of 2010. By assertive, I mean he made long, detailed letters of account and testimony and multiple beautiful, big, easel-sized flow charts with circles and arrows and paragraphs explained in each one. Oh, those things are pieces of art. I got those things hanging on my walls for art. Oh, I tell you what, Stephen Barger with a point to prove is perhaps even worse and more aggravating than our famously cantankerous and argumentative favorite late beloved Uncle Slick, Helmut Fields Jr., may God bless and protect his sainted name. By the end, it looked to me like Michael and Gary were hating Steve, and even worse, they hate me. Hey, Stephen Barger can be a right asshole if he thinks you're lying to him. By the way, I also found it a particularly interesting family moment to sit quietly in court watching Michael on the witness stand with Stephen gently making him repeat a couple of his lies for the record. No, Stephen, I don't remember telling you anything a year ago about how I'm going to make Al pay $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 on the Schwab account. Hey, after a couple of years of encouragement from Key Rock and Judge Cartman, Michael Eli was far gone by this point that he was directly lying on the witness stand rather than even admit that he had seen my simple document accounting for my actual Schwab withdrawals. Nope, he never saw this critical one-page document that he'd been sent several times. So, count in there to the good of this mess that I'm strongly reminded that Stephen Barger is certainly honest and good for his word. He definitely would not lie under oath in a court of law against a brother or anyone else. Thank you, Stephen. Also, Stephen is particularly definitely not a backstabber. If he's got beef with you, oh, he will put it to you directly and honestly to your face. More than that, though, having somehow burned away some weeds of resentment from the fields of our relationship, Stephen's underlying brotherly nature has come out shining. He's shown good concern for my welfare and how I'm keeping the lights on and the coon dogs fed. He specifically has voluntarily absorbed about half my screwing in the estate, including the Malibu, as well as taking and forgiving the entire lien on my home. That's over $20,000 right there, and a generous brotherly gesture for someone who ain't a millionaire. So, do let me take this opportunity to publicly note, thank you, Stephen Barger, for your outstanding brotherly generosity in these trying times. I'd say the geezer would certainly be right pleased with you at this point. Hey, so all's well that ends well, finally. The estate officially closed in April of 2011. Stephen and I both got some hosen, but I got my home. Plus, I've still got the ever-loving Malibu. Howard's humble last car has been the most trouble-free, reliable car I've ever driven. After 100,000-plus miles and surviving a half-dozen court appearances, maybe I should name the car Grace. As a Quentin Tarantino fan, the old man would probably be amused by the idea. And, now that it's over, I do feel somewhat like Butch stumbling out of some particularly nasty basement into the sunlight. Hey, the hosen's only money. And it's worth a little money to know who your brothers really are. So then, that's how the estate ended. But here's a little postscript. As I have been scratching to pay $1,000 in back property taxes, I figured to take the last reasonable legal step regarding the skullduggery. So, in July of 2013, I filed a formal complaint for disciplinary action against Gary E. Smith with the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission. I filled out a form from their website and wrote a formal complaint against Key Rock, boiled down to about 1,700 words, called Complaint Against Gary Smith. You can find a copy of that document and this essay at my lyingshyster.com website. I tried to make it as appropriate and lawyerly as I could manage. For example, I avoided the word shyster, and I didn't call him Key Rock. I did, however, include this Barger Estate masquerade up until this postscript as background. I promptly received a courteous reply from a G. Michael Witte, the executive secretary of the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission. In a letter dated July 25, 2013, the executive secretary said, "Dear Mr. Barger, your request for investigation concerning attorney Gary E. Smith was received by this office July 15, 2013. This matter was considered by this office. After reviewing the complaint, we have determined that it does not raise a substantial question of misconduct that would warrant disciplinary action. Therefore, the complaint has been dismissed. Thank you for bringing this matter to the attention of the Disciplinary Commission. Sincerely, G. Michael Witte." So then, in full fairness to Gary Smith, I will note that not only did Judge Cox side with him against me pretty much right down the line, the Indiana Supreme Court saw nothing, quote, substantially wrong with anything he did. Indeed, I take the very promptness of their reply as a rebuke. It took only 8 days from receiving my complaint to making a case-closed reply. Assuming that someone as much as actually took the time to read my complaint, this implies that they obviously didn't think it serious enough to even ask Gary Smith about it. So then, the Indiana Supreme Court says that Gary Smith is cool and that old Al can go pound sand. This could mean at least a couple of different possible things. One would be that the entire legal system is grossly corrupt and debased, because otherwise what more exactly would a lawyer have to do to constitute misconduct that would warrant disciplinary action? Would he have to pull out a gun and actually shoot someone in open court? Or the other obvious meaning of this outcome could be simply that old Al is full of prunes and doesn't have anything to bitch about. Or perhaps it's a little from column A and a little from column B. I reckon y'all can make up your own minds about all that now, because I'm all done talking about this. Unless Key Rock comes up with some reason to sue me for speaking my piece here. Otherwise, I'm all good and done with this now that I've told my story for the record. Thanks for listening. That's my story of the greatest injustice in the history of mankind. And one final note to my late father, Howard Barger. I'm sorry about all this nonsense, Pops. I'll try to do better.